weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to turn to an issue we follow closely on this program, immigration. And I want to mention that later in this program, we will remind you of some history that you may not know or remember, which is what brought another large group of immigrants to this country in an earlier era. But first to the news, the White House has announced that it has ordered a fresh look at deportation practices. President Obama met with Latino activists on Friday to talk about the issue. One of the leaders at that meeting was Janet McGuire. She's head of the National Council of La Raza, one of the largest Latino civil rights groups in the country. She's with us now from her home in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us once again.
Sure. It's great to be with you, Michelle. Thank you.
Also with us, Fernando Espuelas. He's host and managing editor of the Fernando Espuelas Show on Univision. He's also with us from time to time, and he's with us from his Washington home as well. Thank you, Fernando, for joining us as well.
Thank you, Michelle. My pleasure.
So, Janet McGuire, let me start with you. What came out of the meeting with President Obama?
Well, I think it was a common goal and a unified front to agree to keep pushing Speaker Boehner and the House Republicans for a legislative solution. It's the only permanent fix to our broken immigration system, and we all agree that there is still a window of opportunity to see that happen, even though there was some question as to what the percentages are. We want to make sure we will push for a legislative solution, and it has been part of our three-pronged strategy at the National Council of ASA to push for a legislative fix, to try to get some administrative relief, and then to push also on an electoral front. And so we're working those strategies and trying to make sure that we're moving forward. And so we do want to make sure we can continue to keep pressure on the House Republicans. But the president also agreed to review deportation policies. And we were encouraged by this action and by the fact that Secretary Jay Johnson will be conducting and leading that review. We know that the president is sympathetic and feels the pain of family separations, we also believe that he can do more.
In fact, well, to that end, though, you also called him deporter-in-chief at an event earlier this month. Do you stand by that statement?
Well, look, Michelle, every day we hear new stories of families being torn apart and children losing their mothers and fathers. And the fact is that we're about a few days away from hitting the 2 million mark when it comes to the number of deportations that have occurred in this administration. It's more than any other president in the history of the U.S., and it's faster than any other administration has hit that high a mark. And the majority of those folks are who have been deported are individuals without a criminal record. So for us, this is a real crisis, a humanitarian crisis in our community, and it is a fact. He has deported more individuals in his administration than any previous president.
Okay. So, Fernando Espuelas, so let's turn to you. That you've been critical of the tone, you, among others, have been critical of the tone that some Latino activists have been using in this policy debate to this point, and also of the strategy. I mean, your argument, or you argued in an interview that focusing on the, quote, magical realism power that Obama supposedly possesses actually detracts from or takes attention away from the real problem, which is this partisan divide, which has kept a bigger reform from taking place. So what's your concern here?
Yeah, well, I do think that this is at the most basic level an issue where one house of Congress has blocked immigration reform, even though there is a majority of the members of the House in favor of it. And I think whenever you take eye off of that reality and you introduce a new variant, the idea that the president can somehow break the law and achieve, as some activists have asked for, the end of all deportations, which would be in violation of the current immigration law, I think you start entering into a magic realism kind of space where I think the emotions and the frustrations are overwhelming people's good sense and good reason. And just to some of the comments that Janet made, you know, completely in agreement that the focus should be on the Republicans. I do think that the deportation statistics are being manipulated, not by Janet, but just in general. You know, ICE just published late last week a breakdown of the deportations. And in fact, half of them happen at the border, so people trying to come in. Roughly, the say 45% of the rest of them actually fall into the category of criminals, and then there's about a 10,000 group of "quote unquote" others, which is interpreted as the people Janet was just describing, people who have no record, who do not qualify for deportation. But one of the issues that does come up, and I think this is something the president has to deal with, is that there's a bit of a blockade executing his policy on the part of ICE, and you have the officers, the Border Patrol union, being totally against stopping deportations and in some ways setting the tone far away from Washington that they can defy the president.
Janet McGill, what about that? Do you think that that's true? And I guess what I'm really wondering is it really that you feel that the president is not acting within the full scope of his authority, or is he being thwarted by people within the system?
Well, I think that's part of the challenge. But I guess I want to make sure I clarify that we're not asking the president to break the law. There's well-established stacks and stacks of legal opinions that support the position that the president can work within the authority he has and within the discretion that his policies that he created to allow him to do this within the law. And we're not asking him to protect criminals. So we believe that between the deferred action, the deferred enforced departure, between the prosecutorial discretion that he already has, we want him to work within the laws. And we understand he can't end all deportations precisely because of some of the problems and challenges with the ICE union members, but also because there are some folks who legitimately should be deported. All we're saying is that there needs to be a reduction, and he has the authority to reduce those and to protect those individuals who would otherwise qualify for the Senate-passed bill. Parents of Dreamers and those folks connected to the Dream individuals who are now stayed from being deported because of an executive action that the president took.
But a phrase like deporter in chief is not a phrase of nuance. And the criticism that some would argue is that the degree to which you kind of put the focus on him or his action within really what is a pretty significant to the people involved, but as a part of the overall picture, a fairly narrow slice of the pie, that you're diverting the ball from where it really needs to be. What would you say to that?
It's just not true. No one has run, no organization has run a tougher campaign against House Republicans and putting pressure on House Republicans than the National Council of La Raza. We have been sustained in our efforts and consistent in our efforts to move a legislative strategy. And I think folks would tell you that a lot of our efforts were part of a coalition that helped to get the Senate passed bill because we moved a legislative strategy. And we have continued to put that pressure. And in fact, I've made it very clear that NCLR is one of the few organizations, I know of no other organization, that has already launched a campaign to sign up and register at least 250,000 new Latino voters for the midterm election in 2014.
Well,
we've made it very clear to the House Republicans that there will be political consequences that will be felt in 2014 and certainly in 2016. So we have, in addition to the pressure of lobbying and going to the members' districts, I was just last week in two Texas districts of Republicans, making sure that we were telling them we're going to hold them accountable to move a bill forward in the House.
Okay, let's get Fernando a chance to.
We're doing an awful lot to move forward a legislative front that we think that we have to have some administrative relief. And it was in the time that I made the comment about the president, it was really to make the point about how Speaker Boehner's comments that we can't trust the president to enforce the law was a ridiculous assertion.
Okay, let's and hear one, from. Let's hear another. No, for excuse me, Diana. Let's have a. Let's have another conversation. Let's have another point of view on this. Fernanda, what about that point? I mean, you cannot dismiss the fact that Latinos were a significant part of the president's winning coalition. Why shouldn't they then hold him accountable for doing whatever it is that he can do? I mean, isn't this some ways within the scope of the same kind of argument some African-American activists have had about his efforts to alleviate poverty? They can say, look, on the one hand, we support you. We still don't forfeit the right to make demands of you.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that something has been skipped over in this conversation, which is the president is enforcing the law, meaning that, I mean, this is common knowledge, so I'm not sure why it's not brought into the conversation. The Congress, for the last 4 or 5 years, the president has asked for a maximum number of deportations. The Congress has returned with a minimum number, which is higher than the maximum that the president asked for, and the funding to do it. So the question then becomes, does the president violate what the Congress has instructed him to do? And on what basis does that help the situation, which at the end of the day can only be helped by a true act of Congress? And I think what's happened is that, aside from Council Lavazza, there are many organizations that are, for lack of a better word, perhaps more more emotional, less strategic, and they confuse what is the deferred action for the Mini Dream Act, in which the premise of it was very simple. It was because children are not responsible for their actions, therefore the fact that their parents brought them into this country does not consign them a status that is deportable. That's the logic, the legal logic behind it. But the parents, however wonderful people they are, they are living here without the appropriate documentation, and whether that's deportable or not in general, It is deportable according to the law. What the president has said is only if you're a criminal will you be deported, and then that's where you get into the execution part.
All right, we have to leave it there for now. Fernando Espuelas is host and managing editor of The Fernando Espuelas Show on Univision. Janet Murguia is president and CEO of the National Council of La Raza. They were both joining us from their homes where they're snowed in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Take care.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's said so often, it's a cliche, this is a nation of immigrants. So we take a minute to think about what brought another group of immigrants here and what that has to do with St. Patrick's Day. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear from people who really make you think, like astrophysicist Brian Green explaining the scientific theory that our universe is just one of many.
And the image that I like to have in mind is, imagine that our universe is like one slice of bread in a much grander cosmic loaf, with the other slices of bread being other universes.
No subject is too big for Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store and Cafe. Strawberry Fields offers a wide selection of natural vitamins and body care products for all ages, and healthy back-to-school lunch and snack options. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. People around the world are celebrating St. Patrick's Day today. It's known here in the U.S. for big parades, booze, and green everything, and I do mean everything. But it's also a good time to remember exactly why the Irish diaspora and its traditions spread so far. So we called upon Christine Keneally. She is a professor of history and director of the Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University. And Professor Christine Keneally is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There are, as I mentioned, people of Irish descent all over the world, and a lot of that has to do with a real tragedy in Ireland, right? And I note that you call it the Great Hunger. I think other people know it as the Potato Famine. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is known by a variety of names, including the Great Hunger. It's a tragedy that occurred in the middle of the 19th century in the 1840s. A potato blight came to Ireland. This blight appeared in other parts of Europe, but only in Ireland were people so dependent on this one single crop, the potato, which in many ways was a super crop, because we know that Irish people, before the famine, before the hunger, were the tallest people in Europe. But unfortunately, the crop failed in 1845, again 46, 47, 48, 49, and to some extent in 1850. At that time, Ireland was governed from London, so there was a geographical distance as well as an ideological and religious distance.
And so does that mean that, I guess the question would be, could the suffering have been ameliorated? I mean, one of the points that I learned from your work is that in a period of 6 years, over a million people died, and even a larger number emigrated. And I think the question that some would have was, could that level of suffering have been ameliorated?
Absolutely. So Britain at that time was in the center of the largest empire in the world, which had a lot of resources. But again, sometimes people are surprised to hear that Ireland, throughout the period of famine, was exporting massive amounts of food, and not just food, but also alcohol. And so those resources certainly could have been used to keep people alive, but for a mixture of reasons, they weren't. And as you say, the outcome within a short space of 6 years was that over 1 million people died. No accurate records were kept, so we estimate over 1 million, and an even larger number of people emigrated. And most of those people, over 80% of those people, went to North America. And that's one of the reasons there are so many Irish Americans here today. But what's also tragic is that even after 1851, when good harvests came back to Ireland, people continued to leave Ireland. So by 1901, there were more Irish-born people living in America than there were actually living on the island of Ireland.
You know, to that end, we just earlier in the program today, we had a conversation talking about immigration policy in the U.S., and we were specifically focused on the Latino perspective and the Latino diaspora. But generally speaking, given that history, do you find that Irish Americans are still engaged in immigration policy? Do they have that same kind of born here and I over there perspective?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's one of the features of Irish people, that resilience and that ability to love two countries, because there's no doubt that Irish Americans are very loyal to America, but they still really engage with Ireland. So I think there is a very strong engagement today.
Before we let you go, is any idea how St. Patrick's Day became this big thing?
Yeah, well, St. Patrick's Day, the actual parade, was invented in the United States at the late 18th century, as was cabbage and corned beef. That's an American invention.
What?
As well.
So we should stop? Well, I don't know. Should we stop serving it?
No,
then?
Enjoy it. It's lovely that Irish Americans have put their own stamp on what it means to be Irish. And what's really ironic, but I think it shows that cross-cultural fertilization, is now pubs and restaurants in Ireland sell cabbage and bacon because they know American tourists like it and expect it. So it's actually been taken back to Ireland. So I think it is the richness of that emigration experience. It becomes a two-way process.
What about green bagels, or is that a step too far?
I'd never seen them till I came to America. I'd never seen green beer. It was quite a shock to me.
Can I ask you, though, as a scholar of history, so aware of circumstances that led to this diaspora, is this a day of mixed feelings for you? I mean, on the one hand, it is a fun day. I mean, everybody gets a chance to participate, as I said, in whatever way, you know, and I've seen some interesting things over the course of the day, not green bagels just being kind of the tip of the iceberg. But do you wish that there was more reflection about how this all began, or perhaps not? I mean,
I think I wish there was more reflection, but maybe that's for other days. I think it would be great if people could learn more about the Irish history and their experience, because I think it gives very positive and useful messages to other immigrant groups. So I think I would like more reflection, but maybe we'll have that tomorrow and just enjoy St. Patrick's Day.
That was Christine Keneally. She is a professor of history and author of a number of books about the Great Hunger. And she is the director of the Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University. Professor Keneally, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
And to you too.
It's that time of year again for anxious students and their families. College acceptance letters are coming in and federal financial aid forms are going out. That means thousands of students and families are starting down the road of deciding where to go and how to pay for it all. The average tuition for a four-year private college is $30,000 this year. The cost for out-of-state students at public colleges is not far behind that at $22,000 a year, according to the College Board. This spring, along with NPR's Morning Edition, we will bring you stories about paying for college to help navigate that higher education money maze. You can weigh in with your own story or question on Twitter at hashtag paying for college. Today we want to start by asking why college is so expensive and how it got that way. And we also want to find out what critical information families need to make the best decisions. So to start us off, we've called Caroline Hoxby. She is a professor of economics at Stanford University. One area of research for her is college costs and school choice, with a particular focus on low-income students. Professor Hoxby, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I'm delighted to be here.
Also joining us is Marcia Cantarella. She is a former dean at Princeton University and Hunter College, where she directs the Black Male Initiative, and she's also author of the book, I Can Finish College. And welcome back to you as well, Dean.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So, Professor Hoxby, let me start with you. The average cost of tuition at four-year colleges has been rising faster than the rate of inflation since at least the 1980s, that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Why is that?
Well, college has changed since the 1980s. Instruction has become more intensive. The number of faculty per student has risen at most colleges and universities in the United States. And the educational experience has simply become more enriched. That being said, there are some four-year colleges whose prices have gone up a lot since the 1980s, and there are others that have just kept pace with inflation or not even kept pace with inflation. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all story.
Okay, good to know, because I was going to ask you that. Is it really as bad as it feels to the families who are facing this prospect?
I think actually people feel much too much anxiety about college costs. They often pay a lot of attention to the costs of colleges where their children are not going to attend, and they get overexcited about the price of college because they read about it in the newspaper and they really haven't done their homework or looked into how much financial aid their child will get.
Dean Cantarella, what about you? You advise a lot of high school students who are the first in their families to go to college. So what's your take on that?
I'd say that's absolutely true, that one of the things that families need to do is begin early looking at what's the level of scholarship funding that might be available. Even knowing things like there's a federal tax credit for education. So there are all of these pieces that are really part of the how you inform yourself and how you begin a planning process early.
Professor Hoxby, what about you? In our previous conversation with you, you talked about the fact that a significant number of low-income students who are qualified to go to demanding and competitive institutions sometimes don't go. And in fact, it might be cheaper for them than some of the public institutions or the less competitive institutions to which they are drawn. Now, why is that?
Well, we've actually tested it by giving low-income students better information about college costs and about how to apply for college. And we find that when we give them better information, they do a better job of applying for college. I think a lot of students and families take themselves out. It's not that they are taken out because they just could not qualify for the aid they need or they could not pay for the college for which they're really well suited. They decide themselves not to apply because they are afraid that they won't be able to afford it. And instead of seeking the scholarships they could obtain, instead of seeking advice on how much aid they could get from various places, they're really removing themselves from a whole set of opportunities, and that's especially true of low-income students.
Dean Cantarella, I hope you don't mind my mentioning that your father was Whitney Young, a leader in the civil rights movement. This is the kind of question that pushes some people's buttons, but I feel I have to ask. There are some who argue that education should be a civil right or should be seen as a civil right, and it is not. If it were, do you think that that would change the incentive to make the kind of information that would allow people to access these kinds of opportunities more available, or not?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up my father, and one of the reasons that my father advocated so hard for equity in education as well as equity in the workplace is because the two things go together. And so to the extent that we want equal opportunity and equal access to the ability to have a decent quality of life, then education has really become core to that, and a college education in particular.
If you're just joining us, we're launching our series, Paying for College. Today, we're talking about how college became so expensive and how families can navigate the financial questions. My guests are Marcia Cantarella, author of I Can Finish College. She's a former dean at Princeton and at Hunter College, and Caroline Hoxby of Stanford University, who has a particular research interest into opportunities for lower-income students. So, Professor Hoxby, I'm just going to ask you this kind of one more time. Do you have a theory about why it is that the education marketplace isn't doing a better job of matching qualified students with the financial opportunities that are, in fact, available to them?
Well, we studied every single high-achieving student in the United States, and I mean every single one, not a sample, but the whole population of high-achieving students in the United States. And we found that there were many low-income, high-achieving students, 8 out of 9 low-income, high-achieving students, did not end up applying to the sort of colleges where they are likely to do best, where they are likely to thrive, where they are well-matched to the resources of the college and the other students. So it's not the case that they are all finding their way to the colleges where they are well-matched. Now, high-income, high-achieving students do tend to find their way to those well-matched colleges, but not the low-income, high-achieving students. So clearly the information is not out there. In our research, we found that it really wasn't the college's fault. What we found was that it was the students themselves often came from schools, communities, families, where no one was all that familiar with selective colleges and universities. And as a result, these students just weren't applying to many of the colleges where they would have thrived and where they would have paid very little to get a great college education.
What level of intervention would be helpful here?
Well, we gave interventions to about 40,000 high-achieving low-income students in the United States that informed them about the net price of colleges. That's what they would actually pay. It informed them about how to go through the college application process, and it gave them no paperwork fee waivers for applying to college. We did all of these things in our intervention, and we found that that was enough to nearly double the percentage of students who were low-income, high achievers and ended up getting admitted to a college that was a good match for them.
Dean Cantarella, do you want to pick up the thread here? What are some of the other things
Sure.
that families should be thinking about? And could we not also leave out middle-class families, too?
Well, one of the things that also happens is that students, when they do make it, can lose the money that they have. You know, most scholarships come with a requirement that you maintain a certain GPA level, usually 3.0. A student who drops below that level can lose their scholarship, and that often happens when a student is embarked on a path that isn't a good fit for them. Many students, probably a third of freshmen, think that they are going to be doctors and then dive deeply into sciences when they may not have had the preparation, and then the GPA suffers and then the scholarship goes. Or there are situations where students are afraid to ask questions, and this begins even before they get to college. And along the way, they are uncertain about who they are and afraid to reveal what they don't know. And asking a question would presumably reveal what they don't know. So it would affirm a negative stereotype about who they are in terms of class or ethnicity. Asking questions is one of the most powerful things that students could do at the beginning of the process. And what they have to also understand is that this is also a career skill. So it's a good thing on many levels.
I can attest to that. Professor Hoxby, do you have a final word of wisdom for us? So what's the most important thing that people should know in thinking about paying for college, if they're intimidated by the price?
Right. I think the most important thing is for families to start a little bit early. If you have a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old, start now. If you are a senior and you still have not figured out how you're going to pay for college, it is not too late to start. First, think about the colleges for which you'd be well-suited without reference to cost. And then, with your list of colleges, go online and go to those colleges' net cost calculators. They're all linked on the U.S. Department of Education's website, and figure out how much it would cost you. Ignore all of the information that you may hear from your neighbors and your friends about how much they think college costs, or something that you hear that's alarmist. Go and figure out how much it's going to cost you and focus on that.
Caroline Hoxby is professor of economics at Stanford University. She joined us from there. Marcia Cantarella is an advisor to college applicants, a former college dean. She's the author of I Can Finish College, and she was with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Dean Cantarella, Professor Hoxby, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
Just ahead, new media superstars are breaking the mold and starting their own news outlets, but critics are calling out a lack of diversity in their ranks. We'll take a closer look at the new media kids on the block. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
I'm Diane Nolan, host of Mid-American Gardener. Join me this October on a bus trip to explore the Arkansas gardens of PBS host P. Allen Smith. We'll tour the grounds, enjoy a farm-to-table lunch, and we might even receive a visit from Allen himself. We'll also stop in Memphis and experience Beale Street. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World is news.
By this point, we've got more security forces just to keep people back for their own safety.
The world is changing.
There's a huge, huge number of young women veiled, but also wearing tight jeans and makeup.
The world is strange.
Posse Waller, which is a man inordinately fond of jam.
Join us on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, celebrating 26 years of fair trade. 10,000 Villages creates opportunities for artisans in developing countries to earn income by bringing their products and stories to our markets through long-term fair trading relationships.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to finish up the program today talking about an old issue that's made its way to a new platform. New media ventures like Vox, BuzzFeed, and Politico are, or are trying to, shake up the way people get their news and entertainment online. But critics say that behind the flashy interactives and innovative designs, there's something missing. Journalism trend watchers say those newsrooms and leadership roles are overwhelmingly made up of white men. We wanted to talk about this lack of diversity, why it matters, and if anything's being done about it. So we called upon Richard Prince. He's with the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, and he writes Journalisms. That's an online publication that focuses on media diversity. Welcome back, Richard Prince. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be back.
Laura Martinez is senior editor of CNET and Español. Laura Martinez, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Emily Bell is the director of the Tao Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, where she's also a professor, and she recently wrote about this issue for The Guardian. Emily Bell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And let's start with you, because you write that in the rush to revolutionize journalism, quote, protagonists are almost exclusively and increasingly male and white. Tell us about what kinds of companies you're talking about and why you think this matters.
Well, first of all, it's one of those things where if you look at the high-profile launches that we've been really sort of seeing in the last couple of months, and Vox First Look, which is the new venture backed by Pierre Omidyar, Vox's Ezra Klein's business, 538, which is Nate Silver, who came out of the New York Times, Recode, which is a technology blog but had a very high-profile launch, came out of the Wall Street Journal. And then you look at, if you like, the sort of the coverage of this and also the composition of the staff, you see that actually, you know, that there are women in the mix. Recode has a woman founder, Carol Swisher. It has a 50-50 staff ratio, male and female. But that's the exception rather than the rule. You know, you can find two other female founders in there, Laura Poitras at First Look and Melissa Bell at Vox, but neither have the profile of their male co-founders, Glenn Greenwald and Ezra Klein. And I think that, you know, one of the things which is interesting is that when you look at BuzzFeed or Quartz.com or lots and lots of the other startups which are high profile and successful, the very top of those companies are nearly always male. None of them have 100% female leadership. There are exceptions to that, but I would say that they are exceptions rather than the rule. And here we are in 2014 thinking about, you know, a field, journalism as a field, which actually has a majority of women going into it at entry level. It has, you know, we see very good diversity figures at Columbia and other journalism schools. You know, we genuinely sort of have diverse student cohorts. And yet this isn't sort of necessarily represented in where the money goes or the venture capital funding. And actually poking around on a couple of other sort of VC sites, you see that, you know, that the stats are borne out, that really male-run businesses still overwhelmingly attract money.
And why does that matter? Tell me why that matters. And of course, obviously, some might be thinking about Arianna Huffington, who's the founder of Huffington Post. But tell me why you think this is important.
Well, I think it's important because women are not even a minority of the population, and that you know, media does have no influence, and that when people talk about doing journalism differently or doing it better than what went before, which is a statement that you see from each of these new startups, that actually one of the places to start with, well, who is it that we see leading the conversation here and how do we react to that? You know, so diversity is really important in visibility. It's really important in the voices that shape debate. And I do think that, you know, all of the journalists involved in all of these enterprises are excellent. They're truly outstanding. And they do stand a very good chance of reshaping the field. For that reason, it would be great to see different voices and particularly, kind of say, female representation, for which there isn't really an excuse.
All right, let's hear some other voices here as well. Richard, what about you? Do you think this matters? I mean, you've been reporting on this as well. Emily's particular piece focused mainly on women. You also focus on diversity more broadly, ethnic diversity in particular, across ethnic groups. What do you think this matters? This is something, something you noticed.
Yes. Well, the files are just bulging with examples of cases in which people of color have been left out or misrepresented in stories, in perspectives, and we don't want this to continue in these new startups as well, which is why you have the uproar from the people of color as well. One thing that it's a little troubling is that these are young people starting these startups without very much diversity, and we've been at this for quite a while, and for this to be 2014 and still having this problem with the younger people is, as I said, is kind of troubling.
Why do you think that is?
I guess the diversity fatigue, as people have talked about, the fact that diversity is not a priority that it once was in these financially challenging times. But I will say this, while I was sitting here waiting to go on, Bill Keller, who is the former executive editor of the New York Times, and as one of the startups about the criminal justice system, messaged me saying, the criminal justice system, which will be the focus of our reporting, touches people of color disproportionately, as is distressingly evident from the population of our overstuffed prisons, the profiles of the victims, and the impact on families and communities. There is clear journalistic advantage in building a staff that understands and can get that story.
So
he's one of the old school people, and he's much more forceful on this issue than the new people.
He's saying it's priority. Loder Martinez, right. What about you? In recent years, we've seen a number of established primarily English language media companies launch Spanish speaking or joint venture opportunities, and I wondered if or Latino focused ventures. And I just wanted to ask, do you, as a person who's kind of in that stream, is diversity a priority for you, or how are you having these conversations?
In my case, in the Latino case, it's totally, I would say, totally different, because there is two things. First of all, there is the language issue. I do believe there is still like a huge segregation when it comes to Spanish language media to an English language media. It's almost as if they were two separate entities, and then you have a bunch of people whose skills or expertise is to speak Spanish, then we are qualified and recruited to launch a Spanish language spin-off. And let me just give you a couple of examples. I have worked in the past with Entrepreneur Magazine en Español, The Wall Street Journal en Español. And I always tend to joke, you know, saying it's great that I work for the Latino Wall Street Journal, but how about an opportunity to work for the regular Wall Street Journal? And that gets a little tougher. And also real quick to talk a little bit about what Emily and mm-hmm. Richard were saying. When it comes to the figures of the underrepresentation of Latinos, I mean, it's really amazing. The last figure I saw, it was under 3% of reporters writing front page stories in major newspapers are actually of Latino origins. When you think about Latinos are almost 17% of the population. I mean, to me, that's outrageous. And I kind of have my theories as to why that happens.
Yeah, let's hear it. What is your theory?
Well, one of the, and it's not really a theory, but I have seen many, many ventures start and then shut down really quickly because merely there was a business decision. The argument being, okay, so where was the $1 trillion opportunity that Latinos are supposed to represent in this country? So we didn't make $1 trillion in 2 years, so let's shut this down because it's not happening. This has happened a couple of times to me personally, and I do think that the rationale is, okay, so there is 50 million plus Latinos in this country, we're going to create something to cater to them, and then we're going to make tons of money. So the expectations are really, really high, but then these ventures are not given like the time or enough time to happen or to develop. So I think that's one of the reasons that I've...
Interesting. If you're just joining us, we're talking about this whole question of diversity or the lack thereof in new media startups. We're talking with Laura Martinez of CNET in Espanol. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Emily Bell of Columbia University and Richard Prince of the Maynard Institute. He's the author of Journalism. So it's an online publication that focuses on diversity in media. You know, Emily, in your piece in The Guardian, you quoted Nate Silver, who, as you mentioned, left the New York Times to start his own venture with ESPN, saying, quote, clubhouse chemistry is important. And what does that mean?
Well, I'm not sure. Obviously, having a clubhouse is obviously, you know, a bad thing because it suggests something that's exclusive. What he means is it's right to have the right staff. Now, I feel bad in a way that I possibly sort of disproportionately picked on Nate here, but he was interviewed in Time about how rigorous his hiring process is, and he actually has a grid where he cites staff. But, you know, as a statistician, he'll be familiar with the concept of the third axis, and he should really have a third axis for diversity because, you know, this is important because it's not just about doing the right thing by society. In fact, it's not about that at all. It's about a business problem as well. You know, women are interested in politics. They are very interested in sport. They are participants in both. There isn't really, you're cutting off or alienating yourself from a significant proportion of your audience if you don't take these challenges to proper representation in your coverage sort of seriously. I mean, I led... I was board diversity champion at The Guardian for a couple of years when I worked there when I was a board director. And these things are hard. They're hard and they're expensive. And perhaps it's unfair to expect new ventures to get these right. But at the same time, I think in a way they have a bigger opportunity because they have, you know, new staff that they're building from the ground. And if you can make this a priority out the gate, I think it attracts a very different type of applicant. Nate Silver complained that he gets 15% of applications from women. But if you talk about a clubhouse, that's not, I don't think that's necessarily particularly surprising. I think you do have to make positive efforts in the market to signal that you're a diverse hirer.
Richard, what about that? This is an interesting kind of push and pull effect here, because on the one hand, I mean, Laura talked about the kind of the financial instability of some of these startups, and you wonder, well, could it be that these are seen as more risky and that African Americans and Latinos who may not have a deep, you know, bench of you know, family members to support them should the venture fail might be less inclined to apply. On the other hand, you know, Shani Hilton, who is African American, she's the deputy editor-in-chief at BuzzFeed, wrote a very kind of complete picture of a piece about this. And she said that part of the issue is that people of color not networking with the white men who are tapped to run these companies because they're focused on working hard rather than rubbing elbows. And she calls it the twice as hard, half as good paradox. Many of us are so busy working twice as hard and hoping to get noticed, we don't do the networking that seems like, I'll edit here, BS, but is actually a key part of career advancement. What are your thoughts about this?
She's right. She's absolutely right. But there's another piece of this, and that is that you don't have to work hard so much to be integrated with the established quote-unquote white dudes. There's a strong strain of thought among particularly journalists of color that we should be starting our own and doing this data-driven journalism, this investigative journalism on our own African-American sites. But the African-American sites we have are basically committed to celebrity gossip, opinion, and not really investigative reporting.
And is that because they don't get the funding, Laura Martinez, or because the ideas aren't there? What's the story behind that?
No, I mean, I really don't know, but it's very interesting. Some of the research that I've been doing, a lot of one of the, I'm sorry, I read recently actually, and it makes sense with what Richard was saying and the BuzzFeed editor was saying. There was a study in 2012 that actually showed that Latinos in the newsrooms were the most likely to accept the buyouts offered by the newspapers when the newspapers, or in this case, was newspapers, was print. And it was that particular reason. You know, it was the uncertainty, like, am I going to be next? Am I going to lose my job and just, you know, be in the street without a job? And they were, like, overwhelmingly taking buyouts. I think that's, that can explain also one of the reasons why they didn't, or they don't, they're not more represented.
What thoughts do we have in the time that we have left? We only have about sort of 2.5 minutes left. What thoughts do we have about whether this is something just to observe or something to fix or to change? And if so, how? Richard, do you want to start?
Agitate.
Okay.
I wanted to just say something real quick, Michelle.
Sure.
The thing is that I think when it comes to politics, Latinos particularly are not seen like experts in that, right? Like, maybe we can write about immigration, maybe we can write about food, maybe we can write about families, but why are we being pigeonholed to certain subjects? I mean, we can have a perspective to write about politics, to write about culture, to write about anything, just from our perspective. It doesn't have to be a Latino issue for us to write about Latino issues.
That's certainly something that has been debated endlessly in newsrooms about, like, why certain beats are identified with certain ethnic groups or not, and also women, for that matter. Emily Bell, remember the women's pages? I think none of us here is old enough to remember the women's pages, but we know that they existed. So, Emily Bell, do you want to take a final thought here about about this?
I think this is right the way up the sort of pipeline. So I think J schools have a real an opportunity and a real duty to push diversity to train their students in the right kind of skills. That's where my job kicks in, if you like. I think we've all got a responsibility, particularly those of us who don't want a job from any of these organisations, to call out what we see as being, you know, practice which is replicating itself. And maybe, you know, something which I haven't done, which maybe I should do more of, is highlight good practice where there are women founders and editors who are doing great work. And when you're being interviewed as a male founder, then, you know, meticulously mentioning and promoting your female co-founders, even if they don't seek the limelight, is also a very positive signal. These things have a huge impact on how young journalists view the places where they want to go and work.
You know, can I just ask, I know that you are have a particular focus on women as opposed to people of colour. I was curious why that is.
Only because I'm an expert, because I am one, and because I was a senior woman in it, and because it's the, in my experience, as I say, and actually having worked in sort of in looking at how you build newsroom diversity across the piece, it tends to be that if places don't get the gender balance right, they don't get anything else right either. So it's not, as I say, it speaks more to my particular experience. Somebody like Richard is, you know, such an eloquent expert and has the figures, etc. I've spent more time, I suppose, talking to young women, and young women of, it has to be said, every background. You know, diverse young women are a particular sort of, I think, you know, kind of group that we want to promote and see in senior positions.
Emily Bell is the director of the Tao Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, with us from our bureau in New York, along with Laura Martinez, who is the senior editor of CNET en Español. Richard Prince writes the online publication Journalism. He was with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.